Welcome along to part two.
There's another fantastic story attached to this, which is that the first thing they asked me to set to music was the Ten Commandments.
What?
And, you know, aside from, I had to look them up. Work out which ones I had done myself. But, so the deal was always going to be, right?
It's a guy.
50-50 deal. Sorry. A 50-50 deal. Right, I wrote the music, and God wrote the lyrics. Right, and then we would split the publishing.
Way to look at it. There was Vertigo.
Yeah, wow. That was the deal.
God's agent? Who's God's agent?
Well, here's the thing. Well, it's St. Paul Multimedia, I'm negotiating with. So we were going to split the publishing, and it was going to be music by me, and you know, lyrics, the Ten Commandments by God, effectively.
That was going to be on the
screen. Down the road with the deal. Well, this is what's so incredible. Down the road with the deal, their lawyers decided that it would be much more convenient if they took all the publishing, all of it, and I took the other thing. So it's actually registered as words and music by me. I wrote the Ten Commandments. Copyright.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Absolutely, yeah. I wish I could capitalise on
that. There's a Def Leppard album there, isn't there? You can see the Ten Commandments, like the eighth track would be so good, wouldn't it? God.
Yeah.
So suggest it to Joe. Right.
But lyrically, thou must not, thou shalt not, everything starting with that must be.
Thou shalt not. Well,
or our maiden,
actually.
Yeah, exactly. You're right.
A good that's spoken a word. It's a rap would be more appropriate, wouldn't it? Let's face it.
The most irreverent rock band you could find would do it. You were talking about Radio 1. Sorry, it's me talking again. The Radio 1 plug-in stories, you're saying, things that you got away with and things that shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
There was, I was sitting in my office at Atlantic Records, just literally around the corner from here as well, in Berners Street, and a package arrived, and it was the new Led Zeppelin album, Houses of the Holy. And my boss said to me, he said, why don't you take up the Radio 1, see what can happen? So I said, all right. So he said, before you go, go and have a pint in the pub first, like, because it's a big, what I'm asking you to do is a big thing, because it's no one walks in there with an album, just cold. But we're in the pub, and Johnny Walker's in the pub, having a beer before his show. And he said, what you got there, Payne? I said, oh, it's the new Led Zeppelin album. He went, what? Really? I said, yeah. And I gave it to him, he went, come with me. Then we went up to Radio 1, went to the studios in Broadcasting House.
Which Led Zeppelin album?
Houses of the Holy. And we went upstairs in the lift, me and Walker. Went in the studio, and he said, wait here, and it came to one, I think it went on at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and he shut the door, locked the door, and I said, what are you doing? He said, and he went on bang live, and he said, I've got world exclusive here, so I've got the brand new Led Zeppelin album, and Ron Belshay, who was producer, was trying to ring the studio, saying, what are you doing? And he came up, and he was banging on the windows like that, and he's saying, what are you doing? Get out! And walk away about five tracks live on the album. So it was one opportune moment, it's like what pluggers do, you know, you just did it and it worked beautifully. And he was like, you know, Walker was thrilled, Ron Belshay not so thrilled, Johnny Beale and Dorian Davis were like,
not thrilled,
but semi-thrilled because they'd got a world exclusive on like the biggest release of that year.
What about your pulse?
Sorry?
Your pulse.
Oh, I got a bonus, I was well thrilled. Yeah. I got a pat on the back and taken to the pub and got pissed out of my head, end off. But that was the days, you see, you pluggers in those days, you would go to the pub and not come back unless they'd been with like eight producers, bought them all a drink, and you know.
Well, I don't think we were that far from the Capricorn Club.
We're around the corner
right now.
Yes, of course.
That club in the day. Was
and Mari Lloyd, the Mari Lloyd Club, exactly, another one. Used to go there. It was a matter of like, but knowing what you had in your pocket was the way a good plugger worked. And also the other thing that pluggers used to do in those days, it would never happen nowadays, we used to plug other people's records. If someone had a good record, you'd go in and say, have you heard this? And they'd do reciprocal for you. They'd say the same for you if the record was good enough. It was not as bad as it got in the old days. And then people used to shut you out, say no, that's a shit record. Have you heard what they've done? It's awful. But we used to like literally help other pluggers. It was like a fraternity, if you like. It was a pluggers fraternity. So we got on with each other and worked with each other.
That was in the days when you were gentlemen, probably.
Well, kind of. There was more music. We loved music. It was like a matter of like any plugger was in the business because they loved music. I mean, I got my job at Atlantic Records because I supported Tottenham Hotspur. How weird is that? But I loved my music, and like the guy, they recognised the fact that music was my first thing, And a lot of all the pluggers that I knew in those days, they were all, you know, there's names that Nicky would know, like Judd Lander, for instance.
Dave Brown at
Dave
Capital.
Brown, well, he was in your band, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So you just got on and did what you had to do.
Yeah.
There's one instance, there's two instances really, but one was which I like to think proved me to be a pretty decent plugger, was Chain Reaction by Dinah Ross when I was at EMI. I went to Radio 1 with it, knocked back completely. Second
joking.
Week, knocked back completely. Christ, third week, knocked back completely. 5 weeks, knocked back. Got to the 10th week and I was told to drop it. They said, look, stop, just drop it. Yeah, just drop it. What's the point? I said, no, it's a hit. It's a hit, I know it's a hit. And I went to Radio 1 one day and I saw Noel Edmonds, I think it was, and I said, look, why are you ignoring this record? And he said, what do you mean, why am I ignoring this record? I said, well, you know, it's made for your show. And his producer hadn't played it to him. He picked it up, record of the week, the rest is actual history. And, you know, but those days, you know, you were a plugger because that's what you did. Later on in my life, it was a matter of you got a record and you were told to go and plug it. Mm. And it's like, oh, really? Do I have to go and plug that record? It's shit. Truly, you've been my reputation, no favours. I mean, did you ever make a plugger go to radio with a record, Nicky?
No.
No. Because you never give them a bad record, obviously.
That is Radio 1 wouldn't play out, would they? But after
I'm not sure, is that true? Yeah, no, they didn't.
Yeah, no, after they had the Eurovision hit, they said, well, you've had your hit, that's it.
Yeah. Well, England, we gave them 0 points, and did we not give them no points in Eurovision that year?
Probably.
We gave them no points.
Yeah.
Well, ever since they let the public decide Eurovision, we've come last every year.
You were there for the other days, weren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, it
just reminded me of a story.
Go on then.
Oh no, I don't think I can, I'll get sued. It involved Olivia Newton-John, and she was living with Bruce Welch at the time from The Shadows. But the story goes that, I'm heading for a lawsuit here. The story goes that Sacha Distel, I think, had been visiting Olivia, and Bruce Welch came home, and Sacha Distel jumped out of the bedroom window and legged it. And I wasn't aware of this, but I'd been in Paris when recording Sacha Distel, and I came back and went straight down to Brighton. And I saw Olivia in the bar of the whatever, Grand Hotel or something. And I said, oh, hi, Sacha sends his regards. Oh dear, I shouldn't have said that. There was a stony silence. But the other story I was going to tell you was an alcohol-based story. It was Andy Williams used to drink rather a lot, and he got the gig as being the song in the middle of the Miss World competition at the Albert Hall. And my boss, Dan Loggins, phoned me up one day and said, have you got a song for Andy Williams? And I said, yeah, I have. Not one of mine. I had a little shelf with a load of cassettes which said, you know, hit by any for anyone. And I played him this song and he said, oh, that's great. Right, you're going to Canada tomorrow and you're going to record Andy Williams singing this song and he's going to sing it on the Miss World show. So I said, oh, okay. So I tootled off to Ottawa, played him the song and he said, oh, I like it. Yeah, it's great. I love it. And he sang it to me. He sat a couple of hours just playing it over and over and he gets to know it. And then he did his evening show. This was all happening in his hotel in Ottawa. So I went back to my room and I picked up Yellow Pages and I looked for recording studios. And there was one studio in Ottawa and I phoned them up and said, can you take a session tonight, say about midnight, for a couple of hours? I just wanted to do the vocals. The hook of the song was sad, I don't want to be so sad, one of those sort of songs that go around and Italian style. And so I booked the studio. We went to see the show. Buddy Rich Orchestra, fantastic band playing, backing Andy Williams. And Andy did the show, and great. And he insisted on having dinner after the show. So we went out for dinner and he drank quite a lot of very nice white wine.
Mm, yeah.
And then we tootled off to the studio at about midnight. And he'd been rehearsing it with me and he sang perfectly. We got in the studio and he was so pissed that the vocal was sad, I don't want to be so sad. It was just dreadful. But I had enough to work with. I don't know what I did, but just shows you what a few
jellos can do.
A few jellos can do, yeah.
What is that? You know, you talk about lunches and things with people like you. You must have had, or must have had, a few good lunches with people. We used to eat at one of our favourite restaurants, was L'Etoile in Charlotte Street. I don't know if you remember L'Etoile. It was obviously French restaurant. And there was a guy there, the sommelier, little guy, just about 4 foot tall, hunchbacked, like big nose, everything, perfect, knew what he was doing. Always gave you what you wanted to drink. If you said to him, I'm a bit embarrassed, I don't quite know what we should be drinking here, can you sort this out? Oh, of course I can get you this drink, and you have this. One day, anyway, I was with John Waters, John Peel, and I don't know if you ever went out with them two guys, anyone. They were just the greatest raconteurs, they were just brilliant people. Used to laugh like a drone, great story. Anyway, it comes to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we've had too much wine, perhaps. And he said, would anyone, in his French accent, drink? Because I have to shut the bar. And they said, I'll have a port, some of the older brandy. I said, I'd like a brandy and something else. I can't remember what it was. Oh, shit, what was it? Brandy and Benedictine. And he looked up at me, and this is the guy I've known like 15 years, this little French fella, said, you fucking won't, mate. I said, pardon? What did you say? He said, fucking bollocks. He sort of slipped. He said, that's the first time I've ever slipped. He was a little bloke from Peckham. But he kept up this pretense for all these years in that restaurant. But because I'd insulted his intelligence with asking for the... It's the grape and the grain in one glass. Yeah. He said, you don't do it, there's no way. And he said, came out, he said, you're such a fucking idiot. Why did you do that? Every time I went after that, you kept him going in that. Said, shush, shush, don't say nothing. But, you know, lunches could go wrong, couldn't they?
Peter Derulo, I'm thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever eat in Derulo's?
Yes.
In Greek Street?
Yeah.
People would come into the restaurant, ah, madame, good to see you, wonderful to see you. Let's have a table, your favourite table. And then he'd look to me and say, fucking idiots.
Oh, yeah.
Talking of artists getting pissed, when I was like very young and naive, I think one of my first jobs...
Last week.
I worked for this production company in Greek Street, funnily enough, this production company in the studios, and Ronnie Wood came in for an interview. I think Tommy Vance was interviewing him. And he came early, and I met him in reception, and I said, they're not quite ready for you yet. He said, is there a pub round here? I said, yeah, we can go to the Pillars of Hercules. So I took him to the pub. You know, I wasn't really thinking about it. And I said, I better go and check back with the studio, see what they're doing. So I left Ronnie in the pub. Obviously, he was in there holding court. Hundreds of beers had been racked up on the bar. I went back and I said, they said, is Ronnie here? I said, oh, yeah, I just took him to the pub. And they went, you did what? You took a Rolling Stone to the pub just before he's about to do a radio interview? I said, yeah, is that... They said, well, you better go and get him. You took him there. You've got to go and extract him. So I went, oh. So I went along there, by which time, obviously, Ronnie had quite a few. And I said, well, they're ready for you now. And he goes, oh, I've got all these beers. What am I going to do? And the publican says, oh, that's all right. I'll bring them over for you. So the publican of the Pillars put all these beers on a tray. And we went, and there was this little procession going down Greek Street with me leading Ronnie down to Wedge of Muse and the publican carrying this tray of Guinness, pints of Guinness. But yeah, Ronnie was a little bit worse for wear.
Guinness? So was it Guinness he drank, man?
Well, he was drinking Guinness that night. I think he drank whatever anyone bought him, actually.
If you're talking about the Stones, I've got one more story, if you wouldn't mind if I just get this. It was at Atlantic Records again, and there's a guy called Phil Carson, he ran Atlantic. Remember Phil, anyone? He was like a legend. He's just a great managing director of Atlantic Records. And I was a junior plugger for radio. I was London head of promotion, that's what they called me. And but it was like doing Radio 1, and Capital had only just started. And he came into the office and said, Steve, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, well, whatever you want me to do, really. And he said, OK, I've got a white label here. It needs to go to Montreux. And I said, well, what for? He said, it needs to go. Keith Richards needs to listen to it and approve it. Because then back in the day, you used to have a white label, which you used to approve. It was what was it before that? Was it a shellac? No, what was it?
Acetate.
No. Acetate, that's right. This was like the white label. It had been printed, it had been pressed. For approval. So this was on the Monday. So Tuesday, I got on a plane, I go to Montreux to meet Keith Richard at his house and going to play it to him, and he was going to say yes or no. So I get there, car picks me at the airport, go to Keith's house in the mountains up opposite Lake Montreux. I get in, the first thing I hear is, shut your fucking mouth, you bitch, before I put your fucking lights out. And I thought, oh, hang on, what's going on here? Was it with Anita Pallenberg? Right, and so I just walked in and I'm sitting on this chair and he comes in. He goes, he said, yeah, who are you? I said, oh, Anna Menges and Phil Carson sent me. I've got the white label for you to listen to. Oh, yeah, I'll do it in a minute. So the next morning, he gets up and he comes in and he said, what are you doing here? I said, I've got the album for you to listen to approve. So that night, I'm still sitting, I'm being fed and walked and all that, being taken care of. So he says, okay, let's go and listen to it then. So he gets in his car and he's got this Merc, and the guy, I can't remember his name, was his minder at the time, said, Keith, I'll drive. And he says, nah, I'll drive. Now, his drive was down the side of the mountain going down that way. So you had to come back up the mountain, then go straight into a blind bend to go down into Montreux. So he's backed up, he's hit every single wall, every pillar, everything, straight in front of a car that hit him. He's gone, oh, bollocks, and like just driven off and gone down. So we've gone into this, and I said, where are we going? He said, we're going to the studio. I didn't know the studio was a caff. It was literally a caff in the centre of this little village. And there was a record player, almost a dance set. And he doesn't know what he's doing. He's completely not really with anyone. And he just plays it to me. He plays it and he says, yeah, sounds all right. Guitar's okay. Yeah, that's all right. Yes, approve. Yeah, go on, take it back. And I said, well, I've got to get to the airport. Can you arrange a car? Like, to his minder. And the guy says, yeah, we'll do that. We'll get it. Car going to pick you up tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. I said, fine, happy days. So the next night, I'm still sitting there. And it's just now 3 days I've been in there with Keith. So I've got getting to know him quite well. We're having chats and, like, you know, he's actually quite a nice guy, but he's still fighting with Anita Pallenberg in the other room. So anyway, I get home 3 days later, back in the office the next morning because they wanted me in the office with this precious white label to say that he'd approved it. Well, we hadn't signed it. It was like a squiggle. And bugger me, I'm sitting there in the office and Keith Richard comes in to the office. And I went, oh, Keith, how are you, mate? And he went, sorry? Sorry, who are you? I'm like, what? I don't know who you are. I've got no idea. And he had no idea who I was. But the album went on to be a massive hit, as you all know. I'd like to think I was responsible for getting it approved.
That's classic.
Oh, yes, yeah. I literally spent 4 days in Montreux.
What album was it?
It's Only Rock and Roll.
And, but I like it.
Yeah, that's it, yeah, yeah.
I've got a Stones-related story, which is not because it's like incredibly outrageous or anything, but it's quite a sweet, tender, behind-the-scenes story, really, which is that when I explained before that I had stopped off in New York to record the backing track and Marianne Faithfull's vocal for What a Wonderful World for this movie. So we did the backing track with her band in the studio, and then eventually Marianne comes in to do her vocal, and she said, look, it's a bit embarrassing to say, but you know, I'm not at all musical. I don't know anything about music or counting bars or anything. And she said,
Mars bars, sorry.
Oh. She said, when Keith used to produce the stuff I was doing back in the 60s, he would always come in the vocal booth with me and hold my hand and squeeze my hand when I had to sing. And I said, oh, that's amazing, okay. And she said, would you come and do that for me? So I did do that. And it's just kind of quite a nice sort of behind the scenes thing. I was incredibly flattered to maybe be doing what Keith Richards had done back in the day. But so I stood in the vocal booth and we'll just squeeze our hand.
1, 2, 3, sing!
Yeah, exactly. So she couldn't count. She had no idea about the idea of counting music, which is, you know, I mean, for someone like me, because I've been classically trained on piano, though I play guitar in a more rock-oriented way. But you take for granted that people
Count through the bars.
Yeah, count through the bars. Not a lot of great singers are that musical, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
I would have thought they...
For sure, it's an intuitive thing. But she did know, especially if it was one of her songs, she'd probably know how to sing it. Not that she wrote as he did. She did eventually, right?
Which is sad about
the 60s.
Which about Def Leppard earlier on. But Def Leppard, it's a personal thing because I adore Def Leppard. They're probably one of my favourite rock bands ever in the world, next to AC/DC. But you were saying that they all sing.
Yeah, the band. Yeah, it's a kind of a Ringo thing. They all say they're better singers than Joe, which of course he is.
Really?
Yeah.
Joe's a bit of a shouter, isn't he, really, in a lot of ways?
He's a rock singer, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, do please tell the wardrobe story.
The wardrobe.
Yeah, okay. No, we'd been asked to do... We're doing an album, and the label turned up and said, we need a bonus track for the Christmas Greatest Hits album, and, you know, we'd love you... What have you got? We had nothing on the new album that sounded like the old stuff, so I went through the catalogue and found this song. I said, that's the song. That is the song. Great, but it's a demo. I said, well, we need it. It's been 10 days. It's like, well, this is Def Leppard. We've done an album that took 3.5 years. So they said, look, you have to do it in 10 days, you know, if you can. And it had a string arrangement that had to be recorded as well. So we're in LA and we're in the guitarist's house. And I can't think, can I tell this story anyway? So the guitarist.
You said Joe was upstairs.
Yeah, the guitarist is going through a divorce. So his wife is there and they'd row and stuff. And we were downstairs recording this album. So I said, right, we'll do the track downstairs. We'll work on the. We had the drum parts and stuff programmed. But Joe, you can go into the walk-in wardrobe in the master bedroom, and it's fine, it's okay, it's not that big. Mic, a little ADAT, it was all done on ADAT at the time, and I'll give you a stereo mix every day, and you've got 6 tracks, and just do a bunch of takes of the vocal. Next morning, I'll go through it all, pick all the best bits, so you can do the next bit. Spend 5 days doing the vocals, it'll be great. So we did that, and about 3 days in, Joe comes, he's got up to do his vocals, he comes and goes, "Fuck! It's all different." And the ex-wife had taken all her clothes away, so this wardrobe was now... And anyway, we did get it done, and it's still their third biggest song.
So the moral of the story is, don't ever use someone's wardrobe as a vocal booth, because they might move out halfway through the session.
Mm. I had another embarrassing one that I remembered. After Steve Clark had passed away, they got a new guitarist, Vivian Campbell, and the first gig they did was the Freddie Mercury tribute gig, and I was there to kind of make sure it was all okay. Rick's drum kit was all pads, so we had a loom with numbers 1 to 20, and there was every band had a little box of sockets, so they were all number 1 to 20. They did the run through, it was great, and we then came to the loom with the numbers had no numbers on it. So that was awkward. Also, that afternoon, I'd been with Joe, and he was talking to Robert Plant. I'd go, oh man, you know, it's great, and it's gonna be fantastic. And Robert Plant said, I'm really nervous, because I hate the BBC guy. They always screw up the sound, you know. And Joe said, don't worry, Pete, tell him what you want, it'd be fine. So I was like, oh, okay. So I was given, you know, his compression, what ratio he wanted, and a bit of delay, a bit of reverb, fine. So firstly, we had the Def Leppard fiasco where they, during the sound, you know, the minute before they went on stage, the fader goes up for the kick drum and it's hi-hat. It's like complete mayhem. And then I thought, well, okay, fine. So then Robert Plant's coming on, and the BBC guys, lovely, but they tended to think if they're doing something rock and roll, they'd have a Bex. So by 3 o'clock, well, you know, they're... So I'm there, and I said, this is what Robert Plant wants. This is the ratio, the complete right. Yeah, got it all sorted, fine. And there's a little closed circuit TV. Robert Plant comes on stage and goes, oops. He'd muted him, so I just made myself scarce after that. I didn't want to.
I'm playing live now, which is the whole bizarre thing for a film composer after 30 years.
Brilliant.
But I've been trying to figure out how to do my film music, you know, live, because I miss playing on stage. I would like to have been a rock star, but that didn't work out for me. So I am now doing it live all over the place, actually. But
did you play then in Mexico last week for the Day of the Dead?
Well, I played a lot of my stuff from horror films, obviously. But we do it in a very, it's like a sort of psychedelic. Apart from that, because I've got a huge sort of screen, and I've re-edited the movies to fit my music. So it's like Revenge of the Film Composer. No one has sued me.
That's brilliant.
But, Pope as well.
So that's the thing, and I'm doing it with a multi-instrumentalist, guys from Primal Scream and Paul Weller's band. You know, it's weird. It's film music, but it's got a rock context to it, because, you know, I never got to play the solos I wanted to play.
Back in the solo, apart from in 70s, your bedroom, early in 80s. Front of the mirror.
Well, no, I mean, I was in bands, but none of the bands I was in were ever successful. Yeah. So I sort of took this other route. But now I am literally, and we played this place in Mexico City just a few weeks ago, which is like the Albert Hall. It's fucking, you know. I mean, I'm big in Mexico because I've done Mexican movies. I'm doing 3 Mexican movies at the moment. So it's really strange how that whole thing of being big in Japan, all that sort of consolation prize stuff, I bitterly understand how that works now. But it's still, I'll take whatever I can get. So your loom thing, exactly that happened our last gig. And also, you know, the first 2 tracks, my mic was muted. I'm talking to the audience.
Yeah.
You know, it's terrible.
Exactly.
Are you still writing, Nicky?
I am indeed. I've moved into children.
Wow.
That's the...
Well, no, I found that, you know, at 74, you can't really compete with all these young kids. My son is, however, being me and being a very successful pop writer and producer. So I'm quite proud of him. But so I'm now doing Mr. Tumble.
Oh, wow, Cole. I can't get bigger than that.
I've done 3 albums with Mr. Tumble, and really? I'm about to do a 4th. So I am still writing, but not seriously. And my wife writes as well, so I leave her to do most of it. And I just sit back and collect the royalties.
Grandkid's favourite. Grandkid's favourite.
Well, he would be. Yeah. He would be, yes. So in answer to your question, a bit of writing, but it's not really serious. And I'm too old anyway, you know. I'd rather be at home with my daughter, who's 12, and our new puppy. So I'm taking an afternoon off from puppy duties.
Got one more question, Nicky. Were you involved in that last Bros 02? Should we call it a debacle, or was it not a debacle?
I was not involved at all.
Okay.
In fact, I didn't even see the gig at the O2 because I couldn't get hold of anyone to get a freebie, and I couldn't buy. I didn't want to go in the cheap seats, you know.
No, of course not. Of course
so it was hilarious. I sat watching it with my wife, and we just went, "My God." You know, what is this about? And I said, this reminds me of being in the south of France and recording with them, doing that second album, the madness that went around with it. They are insane. They hate each other, but they love each other. Mm. And that documentary really showed that. It was embarrassing, for me at any rate, to remember what it was like.
So what happened to Tom Watkins?
Tom's not,
he was managing Pet Shop Boys as well.
He was. He managed he and I both kind of quit at the same time. He just had enough. He's now not very well, bless him.
Is he not?
Yeah, he's got liver problems and... Mm. Anyway, I'd rather not talk about Tom, bless him.
We were pitching to record that, to film that gig.
Oh, yeah.
At the O2, and they left it way to the last minute and it never happened.
Yeah.
But we were dealing with Shirley. She was like calling all the shots.
Shirley was? Oh my God.
She was the boss. So she was the one on all the phone calls and all the emails. So she was basically the manager.
Well, that's so typical. You know, we're not going to let a professional do something. We're going to keep it in the family, you know. Mm. I remember Shirley when she was 12 years old. She was in a group called Domino. She and a friend were in this group called Domino. We recorded next door here. And then when I was doing the first Bros album with all the hits on it, I don't know why I slipped that in.
You're allowed to.
Oh, thank you. I hired Helena Spring, Linda Lewis. No, not Linda. Shirley Lewis and Debbie.
Linda was going.
Linda Lewis was going to join us today.
Yeah. Was she?
She's Ramsgatian. She lives where we live.
Oh wow!
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of them. And my new neighbour is Graham Coxon, who I know anyway for the Blur. Yeah, I work with a lot. Everyone's moving now to Ramsgate.
That's actually why David moved there in the first place.
I just moved there.
He's a great guy.
The Kent Riviera.
It's like Brighton, but it's got a proper trade.
It's interesting, the people down there.
I just put my publishing hat on again. I've asked Nicky a question. It's a terrible question to ask someone with such great credentials. Did you ever turn down a great song?
I only ever wrote my own songs.
There you go.
So I can never turn them down.
It's, I remember back in the day, like I just remember back when I was at Rondell with John, you joined as I was leaving. We had the
wasn't designed. Like
I'm sure you got me
I
fired.
Would have been very happy to have.
Yeah, you got me fired, him. I know yeah. you did. Now we had this young songwriter based in Canada who came over for a trip, and I was tasked with another guy called Mickey Rowlands, who some of you might know, to take care of this young guy called Brian Adams. And
I never turned down one of his songs. In fact, I did one of his songs with Bonnie Tyler.
Really?
Yeah.
You see, we had the first album, was it Reckless?
Straight from the Heart.
No.
Yeah. We took those songs to everybody.
And
no one wanted to know it.
Exactly. I loved
them. Well, I remember you, this is one of the questions I was going to ask you, because I remember you saying how great this kid was. And he was a kid. But the classics that came off of that particular album, and God knows how many people covered those songs. It must be like huge.
But, well, I did that with Bonnie Tyler. Mm. And presented it to my boss, who was Muff, I think, at the time.
Yeah, it would have been, yeah.
And everybody in the company said, great, we've signed Bonnie Tyler, some great songs in it. Muff went off to New York and got Jim Steinman to write Total Eclipse of the Heart, and those songs got
side bare.
Left.
Because when I joined Rondell, it was familiarise yourself with the catalogue. Mm. Well, the catalogue was Knopfler, Bob Marley, Supertramp.
Beach Boys.
And I went down and everything was vinyl then and cassettes. And in the basement, I spent...
You were on the corner of Heathrow's Road.
Yeah.
Parsons Green.
And we were
I spent hours down there. I mean,
you never came to number 25 to say hello, did you?
I didn't, did I? Yeah.
Well, Mickey and I did come there. We came there.
Yeah. But I didn't realise you'd done that on Adams's first album.
Oh, gosh.
Because went everywhere. I found this album and I took it upstairs to my office and I went, this is bloody brilliant, this guy. But the problem is, until a songwriter has a pedigree, i.e. someone else has covered their song, you can't get arrested. And I pitched all the songs probably to the same artists and producers that you had. Mm. And of course then, 6 months later, the Reckless album came out.
Yep.
And that was it. And then the phone didn't stop ringing. Yeah. You got any spare Brian Adams songs?
Yeah.
I said, well, I sent you about 15 2 years ago, and you're just like, hey, yeah.
So
you're just lemmings off a cliff.
Which begs the question, what should I do with my Ed Sheeran co-write?
Sign it over to me for publishing. Yeah.
I'll sing it.
Have you got one?
Yeah. He slept on my sofa when he was 18.
Nicky could produce it. Well, you could produce it together.
I'd go back to plug-in for that one.
Yeah. Well, let's put it out on the Rock Tales label.
Can you release it? You wouldn't have the rights to it, surely not.
No.
Not his third, no.
No.
I remember in 2003 or 2004, I reckon a company guy saying, there's autotune on this, that's dead, it's happened, it's gone. It's like, okay.
There's all what?
Autotune.
Still
there.
Stevie, going back to your plug-in stories, there was the time in the 80s where they got fed up with the pluggers going in and they locked the doors.
Yeah.
I was at Rondor at the time.
Yeah.
We had about half of the songs on the John Farnham album.
Oh, right, yeah.
And nobody here knew who the hell John Farnham was. They didn't know he was Little Red Van and all the rest of it. And You're the Voice was going to be the next single. And Adrian Williams at RCA was banging his head against the brick wall at Radio 1. And then they brought down the shutters. Not even Adrian could get in. I think Doreen Davis, was it?
Yeah,
decided, no pluggers for the next 3 weeks. Don't want to see them. And I had a really young guy who was the son of Status Quo manager, and he was my plugger.
Oh, I know.
Because I was a smoker then, I remember walking into a shop one day, and they had these fantastic miniature Shure microphones in black, with a gold pop thing on the top. And the switch that you would use to turn the microphone on lit the lighter. So I bought about 50 of the bloody things and I took them down to a printer and he put You're the Voice, John Farnham on them. And I said, right, off you go, mate. Radio 1. He said, well, they're closed. No one's getting in there. Not even the best pluggers in the world. Then no one's getting in there. I said, well, okay. Put it in a package on reception, send it upstairs. Who's the biggest smoker?
Most of them, yeah.
He was the only plugger to get in for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And the record went straight on the A-list.
See, that's about
all because of a cigarette lighter. But I've still got one in my drawer at home, but unfortunately the You're the Voice John Farnham bit's rubbed off. But the tricks you had to pull to get a record on the playlist.
You do know Rondor, like, who probably one of the most successful pluggers ever was, don't you?
At Rondor?
At Rondor, yeah. The little kid who was our tape guy, office boy, Nigel Sweeney.
Oh, of course.
Guy, do you remember? You must remember Nigel.
Yeah.
Nigel. He was in the office, and I said to him one day, I said, look, do you want to be a plugger? And he went, what do I have to do? I said, well, get a record played. End of. That's a simple job. He said, I'll give it a go. Didn't happen for a few weeks before he went to up Radio 1 for his first record. I gave him something. But in those 2 weeks, we had a band call us up and say, can you come and have a look at us and see what you think? Or the manager rang up and said, you know, we've got the band. And we said, oh, don't get it. Don't see this at all. And the guy was so insistent on like being seen in Dublin. And we said, Nigel, do you fancy going to Dublin and look at the band, do a bit of A&R in as well? Nigel went, yeah, I'll go. I'll have a bit. He came back raving, absolutely raving about this band. Everyone turned him down, but he kept on and kept on and kept on. And then he went on to be their PR guy and plugger. It was U2. That was Nigel Sweeney, this little kid who had not much going for him. He was shy, clarinet player. That was his big thing,
I didn't know he played clarinet.
He played clarinet really, really well, he was a county standard. But he had the plugger thing, he had this thing. Yeah. And he went on to, obviously, Bross, he did Bross, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah, Ferret and Spanner. So Rondo had hit, oh, sorry, I got cramp. Rondo had hit. God, flung this in the car.
I wish this was being filmed.
I was about to break out.
He did all the tape recordings, which we sent out to people like Nicky. He'd be to send tapes out to songs.
This cramp, is it
the Rondo people
contagious?
Did a lot of A&M.
Did you?
Records, there was a band called Livewire who were on A&M.
Yeah.
I joined, actually, for a period after I produced a couple of albums for them.
And which sort of 70s, where are
this
we?
Is early 80s.
Early 80s, okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't a fractious relationship, but Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss said, if the record label finds someone, for God's sake, sign the bloody publishing, and vice versa.
Well, yeah.
If we found something, Nick Kershaw would be an example, which we signed, and A&M turned him down, and he went off to MCA.
And I did all Nick Kershaw's 12-inch remixes throughout the 80s.
Wouldn't
it be good? I did.
What a record that was.
Yeah. He thought I was nuts,
did you
too.
Did you do Nobody Knows? I always thought that was a great
Nobody album. Knows, I did.
Oh, that was a really, really
But I did the Wouldn't It Be Good 12-inch, which they thought I was mad. But I figured out that if you loop the first three notes of Wouldn't It Be, it became the theme to the Twilight Zone. He goes, da, 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 da. So I did a thing called the Twilight Zone mix with the fucking Twilight Zone company. This is before I even got into doing movies.
That was when it was, the 12-inch singles weren't remixes, they were extended.
They were just extended versions. So like
cut the
chorus. Yeah, I did all, practically all of them, actually, for him. And then produced some of his stuff towards the end as well.
But none of the artists had 12-inch royalties in their contracts.
So no, that's true.
Just pocketed
true,
the money.
True, that.
But Nick, I remember when, because Mickey Modern was his manager, Mickey came into my office and said, I said, what's going on there, Mickey? He said, I've got this lad. He said, I think you should have a listen. And the demos were off the scale.
Oh, yeah, he's just a really talented guy.
As a songwriter, he would.
Pop star. He should never be marketed as a pop star. He's far more interesting than that.
I regret you. What MCA
but,
did.
You know, but he's, but yeah, no, that's funny.
As
Mickey
a songwriter,
Modern, I produced
I used
all
to
Mickey
look
Modern's
at
bands at a certain point, and Jazz Summers as well.
Yes.
Probably, no, yeah, really strange. That's how I got started as a record producer.
We should start.
I was just saying, as a songwriter, the thing I admired about Nick Kershaw was that every chorus of his was in a different key. So you'd the verses would set up the chorus, and instead of the chorus coming in the same key as the verses, he would put it in a different key, and it would burst out of the speakers because it was,
he was very, very talented. He's a great guitarist as well.
Fabulous guitarist.
Wouldn't it be good as one of those records when I was working with Andy Hill, we just like going, Peter Collins,
and
producer.
Yeah.
And he's
Wicks playing keyboards.
Yeah,
Wicks. His last album was 2015. I mean, he's still making music.
He is.
Thank Lord, he's still making money.
Was his manager Mickey Modden?
He was managed by Mickey Modden.
Yeah, he was. And Nine Below Zero, that I produced Nine Below Zero.
And I signed
as well. Good man, actually.
It was my best signing.
What studio were you at then?
What studio? I did those all over the place. I mean, the 12-inch stuff I was doing all over the place, in Eden, just wherever the fuck, you know. Air in Oxford Street, I did quite a bit of stuff there.
Quick question.
Yeah.
So you were working in London.
Yeah.
What made you go to Italy?
Food.
Well,
that's a very good answer.
Well, it was actually the band Livewire, who were A&M. Their first album Glyn Johns produced, and then I sort of took over and did the second and third album, and they lost their guitarist along the route, and I went on tour with Livewire in Italy. And whilst I was in Rome, the man I referred to became my friend for RCA Records, asked me, it was actually on my birthday in Rome, he brought me a birthday cake after the gig, and I struck up a situation, and he asked me if I would come back and produce Italian, you know, RCA acts. Which, you know, I did. So I made one album, which was a great critical hit, and then this Italian megastar called Renato Zero. You've probably never heard of him, but it's like called Ronald Nothing. It was a glam. He looked like a cross between Alice Cooper and Elizabeth Taylor. You know, he was very sort of camp, long hair, makeup, Bowie-ish, you know, very gay, but sort of publicly bisexual and had a official girlfriend and stuff. And he asked me, and I did this double album with him, which sold 6 million copies.
Wow.
It was insane. There are these artists around the world in the European countries and stuff.
Italian, Raffaella Caro.
Raffaella Caro.
Was it Raffaella Caro?
Well, there's lots of them. Really? There's lots of them.
I worked with her once. She's an astonishing woman.
And Eros Ramazzotti.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of those, you know, they're sort of singer-songwriters. This guy, Renato Zero, was extraordinary. He was such a huge star. He used to tour. He bought his own circus tent, which could hold like 2,000 people, and toured in his own circus tent with the band. Toured in his own venue. And was so rich, but so... It was like, he was like a sort of Renaissance prince, you know. And he would come in the studio, and he had a real thing for young Italian policemen.
I used to go
in the studio in the morning, and I'd be sat there, and then I would, you know, you get the double glass, you know, which reflects. So I would see him come in, like with a couple of young Italian policemen with submachine guns, who would be like, I was watching them, and they'd be like, looking at themselves, standing there with machine guns behind me. And when we'd finish work, like 5 o'clock or something, he would have a limo arrive, which would take him away, and he had four motorbike outriders wearing leather with RZ on their jackets and on their helmets. And it was just like a whole other fucking world. And it's extraordinary because I'm having to try and explain this to people back in London where I live, you know, I'm part of this insane world. And no, it happens completely independently. I'm sure it's the same in, you know, Eastern Europe and all over the place, all these massive stars that no one knows here. It was fantastic.
I was going to ask a quick publishing question. I don't know if it's recorded. It's something that's been bugging me for years, right? It's just such a stupid question.
Pop quiz.
But if, as writing your own songs, etc., etc. If you've got, say you're Mike Neander, right, and you've written all those hits with Gary Glitter, and all of a sudden it stops, have you got any recourse on Glitter?
No.
No.
Gary Glitter apparently sold his publishing completely 10 years ago, like for millions. So he gets no money either.
Okay.
He got the big buyout.
Because I was thinking, what a bastard thing to happen.
If you want to read a book about publishing, I'm still three quarters of the way through it, it's awesome. Is Simon Napier Bell's book, Tarala Bundier.
All right, okay.
And it takes music publishing from about 1810 or something,
right
the way through today. And it's absolutely fascinating because there's so many things in it you think, I could see why that happened, but I didn't realise that happened.
And it's one of the most fascinating reads. I mean, I think he researched 2,500 books.
Really,
that he read to get all this information from the old chapel boys and everybody and everything that we know about music publishing.
You two were actually out of the room when I was telling the story about the publishing when I was working with the Pope and how I ended up owning the copyright to the Ten Commandments. It's a record. If you left them right, it's on there. Yes, it's registered with CI, the Italian.
You've got the Ten Commandments. Can we do a remix?
I'll explain it very briefly again, if you like. But it was when I was working, the first thing they asked me to put to music was the Ten Commandments, with John Paul II reciting them. So the deal was always going to be 50-50, and I wrote the music, and God wrote the words, right?
50-50.
So, and then we were going to split the publishing. But down the road, the lawyers, the Vatican lawyers, decided it'd be cleaner and easier if they took the publishing 50% and I took the words and music, so it's registered as word, Ten Commandments as words and music by me.
Wow, so that's amazing.
That's pretty cool.
Like I said, I've never been able to make any money.
The Bible must be out of copyright.
Yeah. So yes. But I was just saying, it's a technical thing, of course, but
no, it's brilliant.
Interesting, yeah.
I mean, think how many people you can sue whenever they quote the Ten Commandments.
Happily married though I am, I always thought this was the most brilliant pickup line, really. When this Geffen album was coming out, I spent 2 days being on fucking Sky News, CNN. It was a big deal, and they were pushing it as a big deal. I didn't, looking back at those clips of me on Sky News and talking about this album, and I was being like trying to be clever and saying, let's have enough of the X factor, and if we just move it a little bit, we've got the cross factor. But what I didn't realise, underneath, when I watched the clip back, underneath, there's like a breaking news, you know, they have the scrolling thing, you know, Irish priests being sort of paedophile things. It was like, oh, fuck's sake. It would turn into a commercial disaster, actually, because of that. But
Ten Commandments, the remix.
Yes. Well, I've got loads of that stuff. I don't know quite what I can do with it. I don't know.
Got a studio at home.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do.
Ramsgate.
It's called The Vatican.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as a film composer, you always have a studio at home, and you do what you can there. But
nowadays,
you've got to use an orchestra, you've got to go somewhere else, which is what happens a lot, really.
So I have a Mike Batt story about the LSO. He'd done The Hunting of the Snark live at the Albert Hall, and Stefan Grappelli had played on the album. But he got the leader of the LSO to play the
song. Why are you looking at me when you're
Because you're talking about it, because it's a musician's union story. Oh,
and you're talking I looked after Mike as well. So.
Okay. So Mike's great. He's a great British eccentric. Anyway, so we came to the studio to mix this live version of The Hunting of the Snark with the leader of the LSO. And suddenly, during the middle of this solo, the mics all crackled. And it was 1984 or something. He's like, what do we do? Got the whole LSO. And I said, well, we've got a Kurtz file, we've got a Fairlight, and this was early days of sampling. Why don't we just go through the score and you can play the cellos again. And so Mike and I sat there and one afternoon we replaced everything. And he said, the thing is, we can't replace the solo violin. We're screwed with that. So let's get the leader down. He can replace, say there's a crackle on his mic, replace that. So we replaced that. He came down, loved it. Didn't say, hold on a second. Because they're like 5 seconds of completely synthesized. Anyway, so Mike then went to a musicians' union conference and they were saying, we want more money, we want this, we want that. And so Mike stood up and said, look, you guys have to be aware things are changing. And only last week I replaced the whole LSO with keyboards and even the leader of the LSO didn't notice. And Mike thought that was a nice thing to do. He was banned by the MU for a year.
That reminds me of a producer story. In the days when the band and the singer performed at the same time, right? Big intake of breath. And the producer was some bloke who had some money. It wasn't anybody who had any nous. So the band performed this backing track and the singer sang and... before they were doing takes, they were just rehearsing. And the producer said, excuse me, Mr. MD, that guy there with the silver thing, he's not playing very much. I said, well, it's because for the first 32 bars, he's tacit. Then he comes in for the chorus, and then the key change, and says, nobody tacits on my sessions.
Very good.
We're paying him. Get him to play.
It's about sessions, just quickly. We've all done sessions, right? People you've used. One of the guys that came out of the sessions, we used to recall Top of the Pops and stuff like that, and sessions for Radio 1. We used to do sessions for him, especially. So we had to re-record the track, allegedly, where Dr. Death comes in. And one of the greatest people that ever come out of it, and I met him on a gig, and I said to him, are you Guy? And he said, yeah, I'm Guy, yeah. I said, but you used to do like things for like Womack and Womack, we did, like John Waite, all this stuff at EMI. He was the session bass player we brought in, just to ram this thing. And it was Guy Pratt, he's Pink Floyd's bass player now. So there must be hundreds of those guys sort of playing around. Did you work with Guy?
I did.
Yeah?
I didn't know I was, but...
You are now.
It's just
an amazing amount of people.
I was doing a movie called Hackers, which is Angelina Jolie film, one of her first films, about hacking, which is now incredibly... It's one of those films people dress up and go...
Johnny Lee, exactly.
I didn't know at the time. I was writing the music, and there was a lot of bought-in music. It was actually a really interesting soundtrack for the mid-90s. So it was all of the techno, Prodigy, Orbital, Underworld, Left Foot, everybody had tracks in it. And I didn't know that the director was dating one of Rick Wright's daughter, I think. And somehow through that connection, she knew Guy Pratt. And he somehow got Guy Pratt to write a couple of tracks and got Dave Gilmour to play guitar on them, though they were never allowed to say.
Oh, really?
At the time. They are now. It's coming out on vinyl, actually, very shortly. They're doing, for the first time, a vinyl album of the whole thing. But I didn't know that they, behind my back, got Guy Pratt to write some music in the film.
He was just this young, assuming, like unassuming bass player that we brought in to do stuff for us.
Yeah.
Unbeknown to us, he was like going to go on to the great things that he's doing now.
I actually tried to do a support thing for the thing he's doing now. Sourcer for the Secrets. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
Because I the last gig I did in London, which was the end of last year, this guy pitched up afterwards, and just with Dave Robinson, Stiff Records.
He said,
oh, that's the most amazing gig I've seen in ages, you know. And he wanted to represent us. And we tried for ages to try and get on that tour because it's perfect for what I'm doing, is very psychedelic But it didn't work out anyway. So there you go.
You want to say something?
Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt bought Jacques Lussier's studio.
They turned
Miraval into this fantastic place you went.
It's a beautiful place.
Yeah, because in 1984 or something, Andy Hill was doing a year out, and we were in Germany, and his dad had passed away, and he was a bit... And I said, why don't we go and look at studios? You know, so we drove down in the Volkswagen transporter van to Miraval, and we went up this bumpy... It was a really long drive.
Yeah.
It was miles away from anywhere, near south of France somewhere. And we got there, and Andy goes... Go and ask those people, where's the guy? Patrice, who's the engineer.
Yeah.
And so there's some lights and stuff. They're making a film. And at the time, Manhattan, the Woody Allen film, was out. And I was in love with Charlotte Rampling. So I walked up to these three people and said, excusez-moi, je veux Patrice Kef parler. They turned around, and one of them was Charlotte Rampling, and she spoke to me in French.
Oh.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
But Patrice also told the story. He said, we had this English pop group in called Wham, and they had a week. The first week they sat around the pool and they just drank and they did nothing and they partied, and it was disgusting. I was like, these people are scum. And he said, in the second week they went in the studio and they recorded, you know, hit after hit, and they're amazing.
It was a great place.
Yeah, it was
fabulous. Patrice, that's
Patrice
right.
Kef.
Yeah. Took Charlotte Rampling.
He put the Mercedes in the garage.
Oh, did he? He was
so nice to know that.
Sorry. Yeah. No. What did I just say about Charlotte Rampling? Of course, she was married to Jean-Michel Jarre.
Who? Yes, and yeah. Her contract was that if she was in a movie, he would do them.
Yeah. Well, Jean-Michel Jarre had an album out, and we were working it when I was at Polydor Records, and Jean-Michel Jarre was like open for doing bits and pieces. He would never do anything like major, like promotion or anything, because he's way too big. I'm the biggest star on the planet. So he came and said, but he would like to have dinner in a restaurant. And I thought, fuck, here we go, with Charlotte Rampling, and she's my heroine.
Me too.
So we put together Les Trois, a French restaurant, but perfect place to go. So we all went out to dinner, there was about 20 of us on the table, and Jean-Michel makes his entrance, and good looking man, tables, people turn, all that. And the waiter said, would you like any water? And everyone says, yes, please, I would like water. And I said to Jean-Michel Jarre, I said, what would you like? They do two here. He said, oh, Badois, has to be Badois. So I said, okay, we've got Badois. So he bought some Badois. And they brought the glasses up with ice. So what did he do? Went fucking mental, because the ice was English ice, not Badois. He was like beside himself. He was actually going to walk. Yeah, he was going to walk out of the restaurant. He thought it was disgraceful and an insult to his friends.
He was I did the shows in the Docklands.
Oh, that's the same time then.
Yeah,
same
and time. And we had the sponsor there and the manager, who I can't remember, but they weren't paying people. And if you're street savvy, you know very quickly they're not paying you. And one of the clues was the scaffolders turned up with 12-inch poles and went, 50 grand now, or the show doesn't happen. Okay. It's as simple as that. Yeah. And the whole thing, from start to finish, was a living nightmare.
And it was pissing down the rain.
It was raining, it was horrible, no one got paid. Oh, it was just awful. It was one of the worst gigs I think I've ever done in my life. But Charlotte Rampling was there.
Oh, she was. She never turned up.
Which is the only reason.
I'm glad you circled the square on that story about Charlotte Rampling.
Or squared the circle.
No, but she never turned up, and I was gutted.
I think we need to vacate.
Well, I'd like to say thank you very much for inviting me.
I'd like to say thank you.
Likewise. Yeah. Lovely.
Thank you. I could have listened to this for hours and hours of all the anecdotes.
Right, I think we're done. That's
gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just bear in mind they're pretending, because we're now going to relax and then we'll tell the stories.
Of course, yeah. We didn't record any of those.
And that's where we have to leave it this time round. For Rock Tales 3. Thank you very much for listening. This has been a Podicle production.